Okay. Well, is there any question before everybody gets here that we can try to answer?
You know, I was thinking last night, I was thinking about, you're talking about how you don't fight yourself.
Mm-hmm.
What's the line between, like, self-discipline, like working on it every day,
mm-hmm.
and sort of like not fighting yourself? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? You know, because I'm always like, you have to work. If you don't work, you're that person.
Mm-hmm.
So where's like that? How do you, for yourself, how do you find that balance?
Yeah, I think you're like now listening to the superego, to the
yeah.
The real solution to this. I mean, the real solution to this is to go into therapy.
Yeah,
that's yeah. I mean, that's the thing to do. Like and to go like into a certain kind of therapy that works with your body, not with your mind.
Huh.
Don't go to psychoanalysis. Don't go to psychoanalysis.
Like acupuncture?
No, like Gestalt. You can
oh, okay.
You can find. For writers, Gestalt is the best.
Really?
Yeah.
I've heard of it, but
yeah.
I'm not really familiar.
Yeah. Find a Gestalt. So you can find out where is that voice coming from. How it is like helping you in a way, and so it is surviving, but at the same time it is destroying you.
Yeah.
In some way, that like work is a way you use the strategy you use to network.
Yeah.
But at the same time, have like a part of you tell you, work.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, that's the real solution, to go into therapy like for 1 year with a good therapist. If you feel that she or he's like treating you too nicely, look for another one. You know, that's the key. Yeah, like you really need to go into something that you're gonna confront yourself. So the daily fight you have is gonna get really ugly. It's gonna get messy. So you can like overcome them, because the fight is always like trying to quiet down, so it continues. So it has a lot to do with like working with yourself. That's the real solution. I mean, people who write and who we recognize as good writers somehow have resolved that.
Mm.
Some of them through therapy, some of them just. Through maybe, for example, people who drink alcohol, that's a really bad solution for me. But for some people, because alcohol kills for some hours, the superego, you know, works for them. You know, that for me, that would be an awful solution to take. But I mean, for some people, it works. For some writers, it works. To not have that voice telling you what to do, which is, I mean, the main obstacle. And the other part of you playing the victim.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So there's a victimizer and a victim. Gestalt calls that ¿cómo se puede decir?
Like
pero
the underdog.
Underdog,
mm-hmm.
The victim, and the
dog on top.
The bottom. That's the place that is like happening inside our bodies. Has to do with our bodies, with our emotions. Has to do with mom and dad.
Well, how did you resolve it for yourself?
In that way.
Yeah.
Therapy.
Yeah.
Yeah, through therapy. Through therapy and has to do with your mom and your dad. Like the fight between them, even if you didn't know one of them, like for example, I didn't know one of them, but it's inside of us. So that fight is the one that puts us out of action. So the status quo continues, you know.
How do you get your creative voice from?
Your creative voice?
Mm-hmm.
How you come to you?
How do you get it flow?
Flow, yeah, great question. Yeah. What I do is to start to listen to my, like, personal problems. Like you were talking yesterday, that when you were depressed, how easier it was. I do it the same way. What I do is I touch emotions. I start from emotions. So I don't stop at there, because I don't think that writing should be mainly about, like, or purely about emotions. But I, like, if I'm angry, I start writing. If I'm, like, excited about something, I start writing. So if you are not, like, passionate about something, even if it's a positive or negative passion, don't write. Don't write. Don't write. You, like, only write when you are feeling a strong emotion. So don't try to put yourself into a state of like, I'm going to start to write even though I'm not feeling like I should. But maybe I'm going to get
don't
started.
Don't you want to, like, force your
emotion? No, never. Mm-hmm. Never. 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 Even if it goes, weeks pass and you don't write, don't worry. It's gonna build up inside of you. So just write whenever you feel like there's an emotion there. And don't try to force your emotions, like, to provoke them. Because that's not gonna be strong enough. And then you're gonna feel frustrated, because after a while of like forcing yourself to write, the experience of writing becomes in your head, and you are conscious, like, writing means forcing myself. Writing means feeling like I'm not ready. So don't mess up your, like, association with writing. Just whenever you feel like there's an emotion, write. Because what's Russian formalism discovered, that what keeps the reader what keeps the reader's attention, it's emotions. The subject, those Russian guys say, the subject brings attention, gets the reader, like, interested. But that's it. What keeps the reader reading pages is emotions. So emotion must be throughout the whole book, throughout the whole play, throughout, you know. So in the experimental arena, we think it's mostly about ideas, right? And about techniques, and about, like, strange things. No, it is not. That's a rational Western bias. Like, that ideas or that, like, techniques or structure is what the reader is going to be interested in. That's too rational, right? That's the West. That's Western reasons speaking. What keeps the reader is emotions. That's one of the, like, main things you need, like, to always keep in mind. That writing is mostly about intensity, passions, and obviously, if you can use, like, normal status quo emotions, passions, but there are a lot of passions we can create. Like, we can explore new passions, like Fourier, this French. And he said that there are 810 passion successes. Right? We just use, like, no, like, 10 or 12 of them. We keep, like, repeating them. The simplest one, you know, like, being happy, like, American happiness. Being happy, you know, means something very different than being happy in Peru, right? Felicidad and happiness are not the same. They may be translated as the same, but they are, I mean, I can see an American says I'm happy, and I can see a Peruvian, when she or he's alegre, and doesn't, you know, their body language, their why they're alegre or happy, don't have to do with that. There's, like, for example, in Brazil and Portugal, there's an emotion called saudade.
that which is really a really famous problem, because poets like Pessoa write about saudade.
Saudade?
I mean, it's like kind of melancholy, and and at the same time, there's like a feeling of openness to the world, because you become melancholic, like put down, right? Saudade is like being sad, but at the same time, like opening up, losing yourself. It's really complex. There's no word in Spanish for that. So you can like Milan Kundera also talks about like emotions that, how you say, Czech English, people in Czechoslovakia used to have. So writers, they are like, emotions are not like natural, no? Emotions are like part of the body and also part of culture. So yeah, I would suggest to writers to explore the new emotions and to produce new emotions. Like Greek theater, the purpose of catharsis, we understand like catharsis as a liberation, right? As a, like vomiting. No. Aristotle didn't thought of catharsis in that way. He has been really misunderstood. They created catharsis meant to produce an emotion, as like in theater, as you well know, in a different way than the way that same emotion would appear on society. Like to like purify the emotion, like to make it more abstract, to make it in a different way. So you were like supposed to act in a good way between Greeks if you like portray that emotion in a whole different way that emotion appears in daily life. So what Greek tragedy was all about was producing new emotions through a method called catharsis, which we don't understand, right? If we look for catharsis, they're going to like tell us like catharsis like liberating emotions. No, that's nothing. I mean, that's a concept of Western society. Greece didn't have that idea. Catharsis means to produce new emotions. Bertolt Brecht, you may well know about him, wrote about the same subject, you know, producing new emotions. He was a socialist, was a revolutionary writer, but this guy believes that the revolution is going to start when we produce also new emotions, new ways of feeling, right? New ways of relating subjectivity to outside world, to otherness. So the issue of emotions, I mean, it's like, it's big. It's like a writer becomes radical when she or he can produce new emotions and explore them. So that's one of the like keys of like how to change literature right now. I mean, right now. Not how other people change it like 3 decades ago or 100 years ago. Like, how to change literature right now, one of the keys is to like go and do a research on emotions and produce new emotions. Another, like, really important key to change writers, change writing, change society, is to learn another language. You know, if there's a common feature in writers from the past, I mean, from 2005 to 10 centuries before Christ, if there's a common feature, if there's something fixed in all of them, is that they write in one language, right? So, like the question you did yesterday, how can we like change and go beyond post-structuralism and all that stuff? How can we go beyond? Well, like we have like 2 points right now, right? Explore and produce new emotions, and to write in 2 languages at least, or even to write to write in another language. That's something hasn't been done. I mean, hasn't been done. So that's a way like to produce new subjects, a new subject in writing. I can not repeat this for for the next 2 hours or so, and that wouldn't make it less important. We can all forget about this. But if we are like looking for how to change writing, the language issue is like the key. Like to really understand another language, to at least translate, But that isn't radical enough. Poetry, modern poetry, modern poets became translators. That used not to be a characteristic of writers in past centuries or in other cultures. Like, not in a big way. But since the maybe 19th century and throughout the 20th century, writers became translators. But well, that we are now at the stage where we need to go and take the next step. And the next step is to become writers in different languages. Like, if companies act globally, binationally, right? But writers still work in the old way, in their own national context. So that's why writing is like, it's like in the past, right now. Because companies, the media, goes transnational. But writers, because they are mostly lazy, right? Comfortable, don't act transnational. So to change that and to change society, to change writing, we need to like go transnational. Like for you as Americans writers, to act in Mexico, to go to readings there, to write in Spanish, to let people you can write a play in Spanish and let people in Mexico know what you think about American society, and to show your play in Mexico in Spanish, or to write about Mexico or Latin America in Spanish as an American writer, but in Spanish. That would really change people's mind. That would really change conditions of communication and critique. You can even like give weapons to people who, weapons in terms of intellectual ideas, to people who want to criticize capitalism. You know, you're as an American writer, you know, it would really be powerful. And we could change, and that way we would be in this century. Because writing right now is still in the 19th or 20th century, not in this century. So that's a really important like second key: emotions, language, learn another language, write another language, and also like to build independent spaces. You know, the university, for example, American universities since the 70s became more open to like experimental, avant-garde writing, right? But it didn't last too long. I mean, now the counterculture is mainstream, right? It's on power. It's the new canon. So there's a need now for you as a new generation to like, do something different. So what I think is that something that can be really radical is to open up spaces of non-university, not to try to change writing or society in true universities, like to become a professor there. But that's not going to work, because American universities are going to be more and more controlled, and because of political correctness getting in the way of how much you can like say in class, because American students are like have an attitude of giving, like I need info. So American teachers are caught up in this situation of becoming experts on giving info, and they are like really worried about losing their job, etc. So it's not going to like, there's not going to occur a change to universities. So we need like writers to open up spaces.
I don't know, schools, just or just spaces, workshops, and do their whatever they want. And if somebody doesn't like that, she or he can go. I mean, but we like writers to be radical, like, to say whatever they want. So to open up space, that's the good. Very important key. And well, I can like tell you more, but maybe four is enough. If not, it's gonna become like rules, right?
Like, I need to.
Final suggestion I would have would be like to lose the perspective that the left has had for the last 150 years since Marx, which is to feel, to perceive capitalism outside itself. That's what leftist intellectuals throughout the whole world now share. So what's canonical? That they feel that capitalism is outside. Like for example, we can hear here at Naropa, I remember the first day somebody said that in contrast to consumer addicted society or citizen, we, right? That's like, for me, that's completely the wrong, that's the traditional old paradigm. To think that the problem, it's not you, you know, you're a leftist or you're a counterculture or I'm a minority. No. Or I'm a poet, so that makes me automatically, immediately the good part of society. So to change that perspective that has dominated the left, the avant-garde, experimental writing in general, art, to change that into like to self-critic, that's something that is not being done. Like people analyzing themselves. I mean, like themselves, this, and then their own community. But like to start with me, I'm gonna write a book on my relationship to violence. Not a book about like American violence, right? But like a book about my own violence. I'm then gonna like disclose to the reader how violent I am. For example, because the other perspective is that it has been done, and what happened is that we as intellectuals, we help the building of a society based on blaming, right? Blaming others. So that's, in what way is that different than the family structure? In what way is that different than the church? In what way is that different from the two parties in America, Democrats or Republicans? In what way? So, like, to do a change there, like, to change the direction of analysis, of critique, of deconstruction, and to, like, start with our own life, individual life, and then our community. Like, analyze what's happening, like, for example, in Naropa. What does a Naropa summer mean? And I'm not going to do that as an outsider. Oh, I went to Naropa this summer, and I was like analyzing others. No. That would be the same, right? I'm gonna do an analysis of Naropa, of a summary in Naropa, but I'm gonna tell what I did. I'm gonna do a critique of myself there. And once I do that, obviously, I have the credentials. I have the weapons to do that. Maybe to not do the Naropa institution. And then to the experimental American community, and then to the experimental Mexican, and then to the Western in general, right?
we keep like expanding critique, but critique needs to like start. Like to write, when you write, to write with that perspective in mind. I'm analyzing myself. And the moment like you read, you're gonna listen to others reading about how wonderful they are because they read counterculture, how wonderful they are because they accuse others of being violent, and everybody applauding. Right? That's what we do here in Mexico, right? The same situation. We blame Americans. Every time somebody blames America, we all. So that's all. That's what our elders did, and it functioned for a while. They needed to do that. That's why they did it. That resolved their situation, but because they resolved it, new problems arise, and that's for me to resolve. Right? So that's like 4 suggestions I have. How to, like, for your question like yesterday, what to do. And the fifth is, you know, whatever you find out. And the sixth and the seventh and the eighth. I'm from a different context. A whole different context. And each one of you is like from a different context than the next person sitting there. So there are no general rules how to change writing.
Okay.
More questions? Has everything that we discussed during the week has been grasped? Has been understood? Yeah, I have like this conflict because we didn't analyze the copies enough. Is that a problem for you?
No.
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 Unless you think it was really valuable or something.
I think that maybe I should like talk about that for some minutes. I think there's something like we can cover that. How did modern poetry resolve the issue of how to change writing and how to change the individual? And how did postmodern writing did it? So I'm going to be real straight to the point. Modern poetry decided to change writing and change the subject, change society, through the idea that there was a natural energy that you needed to liberate. And they define it as a flux, as a flow, as something that was like... Maybe the best author that defended that idea and now represents that idea, not only for Americans, but I mean for all over the world, all poets all over the world. In Latin America, you always like... You are taught this in school. It's Whitman. You know? Whitman represents that.
Like, what is the time frame of that you're talking about modern poetry?
Like, especially in the 19th century, when mm-hmm. modern poetry like reached its highest point. With whom? With like Whitman and Mallarmé. That's like the point of explosion. And obviously also Baudelaire, Rimbaud. Mostly French, right? Mostly French, I mean, 19th century, yeah. Mostly French. And then that's before the avant-garde. That's before Dadaism in 1910, Surrealism during the 20s, during the first 2 decades of the 20th century, it's all about avant-garde. The 2 most important avant-garde movements, Dadaism, that broke the role of logic in writing to write nonsense, Dadaism, and Surrealism that brought the concept of an unconscious plane apart in writing, like how to communicate with the unconscious,
right? That's like the two most important breakthroughs in writing in during the avant-garde, during the two or three, really the two first decades of the 20th century. But before that happened, we had something happening in the 19th century, like from 1840 to 1880, and then stop for a while, right? What happened before the avant-garde? Poet defining herself or himself as a master, as somebody who could devour, could like eat society, could build a bigger body. This comes from Blake also. Blake, for example, says that what we define as the body is just this is Blake. An English writer, romantic. What we define as the body is only what the five senses can see and perceive about the body. This is very important. This is very important because modern poetry is how to increase the body, how to reach what's your body already. But because of the five senses and because of what he calls reason, you cannot recognize as yourself. I have a quote here. Okay. For that cold body is a portion, part of soul. That cold body is a portion of the soul discerned, perceived by the five senses. And it is the bound, like the border. It is reason is the bound or border or outward circumference, is that how it's pronounced? Of energy. Right? This is called what he called soul. And the body is just a part of that.
Soul is something big, like, I'm not sure I understand that.
Okay. Batai? And the Marquis de Sade?
Uh-huh.
Both of them don't call this the soul. They call it the monster. The monster.
It exists outside of you. There's like one that we all share. Like,
yeah.
Is that it? Like we're all tapping into the same.
That can be something. That's a version of it.
Okay.
Some of them say that there's a monster, and each of us some different monster.
Oh. What happens? Like, so your monster moves with you?
Yeah. Like.
What happens when the monsters start crashing into other monsters? Can that happen?
Yeah.
Or are they one? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Oh, that's Burroughs called that control. When two monsters
control is an authority. Control?
Yeah, and as madness. When two monsters like collide, here's her monster, my monster, control starts to happen. Mm-hmm. Burroughs is all about that. I have a friend who writes poems. He's a great poet, and he says that he sometimes feels like there's like he's like oppressed by this bigger force. There's like a window here, right? Like a window here, and I can be like this. But he says that his grandmother can see something big. And that's what he feels that has taken over him. That he is smaller than his monster. This is like something really important. This is what romanticism is all about, right? John, the psychoanalyst, calls that, this is called by him, for example, anima. And he says that, for example, poets or individuals in general have a problem when it's bigger than what he calls self. So what the solution he gives is to open up self until self and anima are the same. If self is smaller than anima, then you have an individual that's going to become mad, or at least not going to be happy in his or her life. John, Bataille, Marquis, even Fourier, by the way, Blake, have different names for this, right? Have different names. The same experience, the same like vision. This is this in Mesoamerica. So we may know, if you are interested in that, it's called Nahual. Nahual. This is Nahual. So like, if you need to like contact your Nahual, and then you become a powerful individual. You become a shaman. The equivalent like of like poets, right, in our society. So this is some of them knew it. Some of them had even notions and definitions of it, like Blake, right? He writes about this in the Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Read that. There's a point where he says all Bibles are composed of three lies. It is the three lies. And the real three truths are, and the second one is what I explained. Blake has conscious of this. Is conscious of this. Other poets are not conscious of this, but their work is about this. He was conscious about this. He was conscious about this. Mesoamerica was conscious of this. John is conscious of this. Other poets aren't. For example, Whitman is kind of conscious of the fact that poetry needs to be a technique on how to increase the measure of the body. He talks about that. That's why he invented like... What did Whitman invent? Free verse, right? Poetry used to be like control measure. Like sonnets, right? And Whitman invented a longer verse, a longer line. Why? Because he needed to expand the body of poetry. Am I making sense?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's why in Whitman, and in, not only in terms of form, poetical form, but also in terms of content. What is Whitman's poetry about? Somebody knows?
His body.
His body, yes. And a whole bunch of lists of things in general. Rivers, mountains, people, events. Like a list, like a chant, like an incantation, like a invocation, like the tree, and then, so I can like, he calls that, this is very important like, for you, this he calls that American. That growth, that new territory, he's like increasing, is American. Like, look, like expansionism. In his case, an expansionism linked with a metaphysical purpose, a poetical purpose, and also to a military expansionism, right? Whitman was in favor, for example, of taking over Mexican territory, you know, that Americans stole. So it's about, like, in him, it's about, like, growth. Why? Because he's talking also about this. He's calling the movement from here, from the boundaries established by reason, from here to here, he calls that movement America. And he talks about how America is going to become.
Right? So if the anima is too big, mm-hmm. then that's what happens when, with in Whitman's case, that he wants to take over the whole world.
Yeah.
Because the anima is too big.
It's too, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And Baudelaire calls that Dandy. Dandy is a guy here, is this, that when French cities appeared, the dandy wanted to, because the boulevard opened in Paris, and now people could see a new open horizon. And so, like Marshall Berman writes about this, how Baudelaire poetry is all about, like, that increased zone of perception. That's where modern poetry comes from, like the avant-garde, right? The cities. So city increased, perception increased. You could now see a rich family and a poor family in the same space, which didn't used to happen. But you now can see that because of the boulevard in Paris, of that big space, open space, that open up the city in two, and so from the two sides of town, people encounter each other. So that space, according to Marshall Berman and according to Baudelaire himself, provoked this new kind of, like, poetry, of vision in poetry. So Baudelaire calls the dandy, you need to be a dandy, which means not like you drink coffee and are cynical, but it means that you are going to eat the world through your eyes. You're going to see it all. So the mission of the dandy is to see it all and to eat it and to have it in your mind. So the dandy, this is, you can read this in an essay called "The Painter of Modern Life" in English. That must be the title. The Painter of Modern Life. And he explains how you need to become a dandy. In his vision, the dandy would be somebody hartazgo, Ruben. Okay, can say that. If I'm harto, I'm
sick of.
Yeah, sick of, and also like when you eat, I'm like, I'm full. Like, I'm harto is like completely full of something.
You've had enough.
Uh-huh. So he says that dandy, you know you're a dandy, and you're now a dandy if you had enough. So dandies don't believe in anything. They don't even see anything new anymore, because they already have seen it all. And he says you need to achieve that as a poet, right? This is really different than Whitman's attitude to it, right? We're seeing like two different attitudes of writers, of cultures, talking about this. I like to call it Nahual because I come from Mexico, right? So different attitudes about Nahual. Pound had a different notion of that. When he went to London, he discovered that London was so much exciting than America. Right? At that point, we're talking about the beginning of the 20th century. So he used to have a lot of dialogue with painters there in London, and he said at one point that London for him was a kind of vortex. Are you familiar with the word vortex?
What is a vortex?
Like a center, something.
Like when in the water, like that could be a vortex. Something that's a point where things unite or start from. So he says that we need to conceive every page as vortex. That notion came from his experience in London, where he said, everything is happening here. This is an exciting place, not like the US cities. But London is great. London is a vortex. Perhaps how, according to vortex functions, having so much energy that it attracts like a black hole, right? So he had this same notion, right? The poet as a vortex, the page as vortex, right? I'm gonna like give the microphone to my leftist poet in me, and I can say, yeah, both these guys, especially these two, are doing in poetry, are poeticizing empire. Their poetry is the poetical equivalent of political expansionism. They made it beautiful. They made it spiritual. They turn imperialism into something really, really beautiful. Am I explaining that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's a very important writer, Olson, Charles Olson. There are books by him here. And he defined, we have that in copies. We have the definition of town, of vortex, it's there, right? We have something on Whitman there. So, I think I didn't bring anything by him. I chose like Americans for you to be more familiar with. But also defines a space exactly as a vortex, as America, as Dandy, as the master, as Nawan. So reread that, please, whenever you can. How Olson defines space. Look, this is the key to understand this notion. Suppose there's a way, there's no way, but let's imagine. Suppose there's a way to stop time. And at the same time, to keep accumulating what used to be divided through time. Okay. Let's suppose time disappears. It cannot disappear. But let's suppose it disappears. But what used to appear through time now appears only in space. Like my grandmother, my mother, my sister. They used to be divided. When my sister was born, my grandmother wasn't there anymore. Mm-hmm. But in this case, we're going to disappear time. And so we're going to have a new space, a new kind of space, a new experience of space. This is what modern poetry and postmodern poetry is all about. Okay, so pay attention to this. So my grandmother is going to appear, and then my mom, my sister, and then all the three of them are going to exist simultaneously. So we have created a space that doesn't lose anything, but keeps gathers and keeps growing. Like a collection, right? Without history, because history is like, without history, you remove history. So that fantastic space, that new experience of space is what Baudelaire wanted in the Dandy. Where was that space in Dandy? How did Dandy achieve that? Where was that space created in Dandy? His mind. He got a memory. Dandy needed to increase his memory or her memory. So this space was memory. In the case of Dandy, was memory. In the case of Whitman, where was that space being constructed? There is. America. What he calls America, which is a country and also like a kind of a spiritual state. Right? In Pound, he was less ambitious on the page. That can happen in pages. Read Pound. Pound's cantos are like about quoting Romans, Chinese sources. Like every page of Pound is like a bank of information. Ed Sanders does the same thing. If you want another American writer who does that, Ed Sanders. Okay? The other day, Anne Waldman spoke briefly about him, like saying he researches a subject, he builds an archive, and then with that archive of information, he writes. That idea came from Pound. Olson used that. Olson, who was very jealous of Pound's ideas, like transformed it. He called that space instead of vortex. And he had similar ideas to Whitman, even though he didn't accept it, because at that point Whitman wasn't cool enough for American poets. No. Whitman became cool after Ginsberg, again.
What was the time period? When was Pound alive?
In the 30s, 40s?
19?
Yeah. In the 50s, he was in jail because he became a fascist in Italy. And after the Second World War, the American government trapped him, bring Pound in a jail, and jail him in a madhouse in St. Elizabeth. Because he used to talk pro-Italian fascism in the radio, in Italian radio. And when the Americans won, they brought Pound back and put him in a jail, in a madhouse. And so Olson went to St. Elizabeth to talk with him.
Why were they interested in him?
Because of that notion. Because he conceived the page as a new field. American poetry is all about constructing a new field, a new space. They all of them talk about that. That's why it's really interesting. American poetry is really interesting. Because why? Because the America received so much immigrants, it started to develop capitalism, and so people who are sensitive to that, metaphysical people like poets, maybe unconsciously started to imagine a new relation to space. Some of them realized it had to do with America and social conditions, you know, that their internal images had to do with social conditions. Some of them didn't know. Doesn't matter. I mean, in terms of poetry, it doesn't matter. So Pound was very important for American poetry because he redefined the space of the page. Prior to him and others,
The page was defined as the place where the soul, the individual, the person, represented herself or himself. Right? There's a big difference, right? But the Romantics started to view the page as an open field of joining me with otherness. So that completely changed the face of literature. Foucault, this theoretician, Michel Foucault, says that literature, as we know it, didn't start it until the 19th century. He says that it starts with Mallarmé. Right, the first page of our... This is Mallarmé. The book suppresses time. He's like the first one to know that. The book suppresses time. That's why he writes like this, all over the page. He has more radical poems using the whole space of the page. You can even read like this and this in two pages. What the most important poem was published in a newspaper because he believed that for the new poetry needed bigger space. Right? So it has a lot to do with imperialism, with social conditions in Europe and United States and Latin America. Right? All of them talk about the disappearance, like Klefnikov. This is by Klefnikov. He says, the feeling of time vanishes. The feeling of time vanishes. And it begins to resemble a field in front of you and a field behind. It becomes a kind of space. And you can read that throughout like a whole bunch of poets. Like, I've been doing research on this. This is why I can locate those quotes. And I've written books in Spanish about this. Like how modern poets throughout the world share this idea that time is vanishing. And that what used to be separated in time now appears in a new space. I started to see how much that idea appeared here in Russia, in the US, in Latin America, and in Europe, definitely. I don't have enough knowledge of Asia and Africa, but I'm sure something similar would happen there in a different way. I saw so much of them that I decided it wasn't a coincidence. It had to do with imperialism. It had to do with the feeling that history was like, the notion of history was disappearing. And that we were changing paradigms of perception through capitalism and through, like, in a paradoxical way, through ancient knowledge. So there's like a really problematic, in all of them, a really problematic relationship between ancient knowledge and capitalism. Right? Olson went to Mexico. His ideas on space and what he calls the will to cohere, which I understand because I like to play with words, right? As a cohere. Like co, like with. Co comes from Latin, means with. Co. Like coexistence. Coexistence. A cohere. So he is, all of them are about a cohere. Right. I saw this throughout literature that I decided to put a name to it. I called it Pantopia. How you pronounce that in English? Like utopia, but Pantopia? Pantopia. Yeah, Pantopia. But pan comes from, what does pan mean?
All.
Exactly. Thanks, yeah. All and topia, topos, like a topology, place. So a total place, the place of all,
All includes what? Time, people?
Time, objects, entities, processes. All of them are very ambitious. They want to build, they want to write in a space that can have it all, can handle it all. History, data, not only myself, but others. All of it included there. Right? So, I define all of those and others, like I can put here like more Latin American names, like there's Dale Sama Lima, who calls this experience Gnostic space. Gnostic space, Gnostic comes from this is by a Cuban writer, Lezama Lima, middle of the 20th century, in the 50s, almost at the same time, even before also. He calls this Gnostic space. And he says that America, but he means not only the United States, but America, the whole continent, he means, and especially he means the Spanish from Mexico to the south and Cuba. He defines that our culture is different because it built it a Gnostic space. By Gnostic, he means Gnosis, from the Greek Gnosis, which means knowledge. A space where knowledge is gathered. He, for example, says that the new Baroque, the Latin American new Baroque, like in churches, or even in language, even in food, which is a combination of European elements with indigenous elements together. Yeah. So in the U.S., when Englishmen came, they exterminated Indians, right? So there was no mestizaje, no mix. Your culture is not a mix of, like, those two worlds, right? Well, several worlds. Because they eliminated extermination. Because of different ideas by Protestantism and Catholicism, right? And the Spaniards did mix. So Latin America is a combination of several cultures. Like a new Baroque. More and more elements. A Summa. Gathering. So he defines Latin American culture as a suma, as a Gnostic space. Right? The same notion, right? The same notion of increase, Lezama Lima says that in Latin America nothing disappears. You just keep adding layers. Like Indian culture, Spanish culture, like a temple, has the base, it's rocks, stones, Indian stones, and then you build on top of that a Christian church. And then, after independence. So you can be in cities in Mexico or throughout Latin America, and you can see historical layers simultaneously present. You know, because it's a summa. So he wrote his poetry using that idea of adding knowledge from the Chinese culture, from Mexican culture, from French. I can keep going, like, right? There are like several pantopias Some of them believe that Pantopia was something that was natural, that the world was really a Pantopia, and you just needed to be aware of it. That's what modern poetry is all about, of that belief. Postmodern poetry is about knowing that gathering is artificial. It's that really an all. It's just a sum of parts.
So there's a little difference there. There's a little difference there.
So that was what Lefebvre was talking about with the production of space. That it's a that is produced.
Yeah.
He created that.
As you can like listen, it, when you listen to literature, anthropology also, what you're in the last two centuries, it's all about space. It's all about space. So space became a very important category. Borges also had an idea of an Aleph. I'm just the last one. Aleph is a point. There's a short story by him. A point where this was in a house of a poet that was going to be demolished, and then a character in the short story doesn't want for the house to be demolished because in a staircase inside the house there's a point that if you look into it, you can see the whole world included in one point simultaneously. So you can see London and at the same time you're like mother having sex, mm-hmm. and then yourself when you were a child, and yourself seeing through that point, etc. He calls that Aleph Borges. So we have again the different a different way of portraying a Pantopia. So it goes. I mean, if you can read in Spanish, you can read. Okay, I hope someday you can read in Spanish. So this is very important for us. Why? Because a new definition of empire would mean the transformation, the fantastic transformation of time into what? The transformation of time into space, a total space. Yeah? That's what an empire is all about. So whenever time is transformed into space, an empire arises. Even the word empire means to stop. The root of the Latin roots of empire, like to prepare in English, right? Prepare. In pero. Pare, pero are the same root. Means to stop, to gather, to like to prepare, right? To have it here. So an impero is a place where something has stopped and is, because it has stopped, it is now building up. So writing and empire have a lot to do with one with the other. Right. As writers, what we do is to stop time and to build a new space, the page, where we are going to gather our experience, other people's experiences. And this feeling has been increasing in the last two centuries, how to prepare that space. And obviously, here the problem is that there's like even an a spiritual objective in this to like grow, right? Like to recover Nahual, all of that. But this in our reality, what constructs is imperialism. So there's a counter movement to that. Inside of these two centuries, there's a counter movement, which doesn't consist of gathering, writing, right? Writing as gathering, but as... What do you think is the opposite direction of what?
To give it away.
To give it away. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to give it away. That, for example, Bataille said that we need to conceive writing as and Miranda, who has studied anthropology, can explain to us what this is.
I have no idea.
A potlatch is like a way of changing goods, in exchanging gifts between certain cultures. So potlatch is, suppose I'm a culture, he's another culture from certain regions of the world. So we get into a war. This is a way of doing war. So I give him gifts, like five apples. And then the next day he's gonna come to my village with 10 apples. Okay, so 10 apples, I'm gonna give you 15 apples and three slaves. He's gonna come 40 apples and 20 slaves for you. Until one ruins the other because of so much giving. Right? That's potlatch. Giving, until you ruin yourself. This is a way of doing war. So others, like for example, we read Cage, right? John Cage. Cage does it through what he calls silence. Do you remember the lines? Poetry is something like that. Poetry is born when we realize we have. Does somebody remember?
Nothingness.
We have nothing. That means that for him, for Cage, poetry is exactly the opposite that for Pound. Cage was a Buddhist. It's all about Buddhism. Like what in English, non-attachment, which is the opposite thing to, remember I said the first day, I like to use like United States in a different sense. They all of them want to United States, put them together, like Pentopia. United States is just another word to describe Pentopia. Yeah. Well, there's like cultures, individuals, writers, thinkers who preach the other way around, to have non-attachment, to give it away, potlatch, etc.
Potlatch, I thought had, wait, is it potlatch as a negative or as a positive thing?
Both.
To give somebody so much that they now can't do their own thing, or I don't.
For example, yeah, it's okay. Both. It's both. It's a contradictory experience. It's to ruin. It's a way of war. It is about like ruining. About.
So.
And at the same, but they are also.
So how does that have to do with something like the World Bank or the IMF that we were talking about yesterday? That's potlatch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's part one.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you explain that more, like the IMF? Like giving the loans to people that you know that they can't pay back, that they have to come back and give the loans, and like...
That's part
one. Like, okay. And so you're trying to ruin the other person, not yourself,
yeah.
Right? It's sort of the like flip side of non-attachment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, it's like different. Like this one's, right? Between them, they're like there's a similar like logic in them.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're not exactly the same. You're right. There are different versions of how to gather.
Yeah.
Also, different versions of how to give away. You know, like the new Baroques, the same guy, Lezama Lima, had this same like definition. They had the writing as building and space to like. Produce the experience of emptiness. So, like in poetry, I'm gonna because others poetry as a place where I and other guys, other people, other writers, poetry as a place where I'm gonna like empty myself. Like yesterday. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Like, to use poetry as a tool to experience emptiness, as an experience of...
To evoke it in someone else or to experience it in yourself?
In yourself.
Okay.
Remember, this is the thing. Poetry is contradiction. Because poetry comes from writing. Writing was born to make lists. The first tablets we have of writing throughout the world are lists of objects or histories of emperors. So writing was invented for empires. So there's no way writing cannot have a relationship to imperialism. It is a tool of imperialism. Like Levi-Strauss, this is the anthropologist, went to Brazil, he made notes on the Nahuica, and then a chief of the Nahuica, of these Indians, started to see him writing. That culture has no writing. And so one day, Levi-Strauss went outside the village, and then he returned. When he returned, he saw they were gathering, seeing something. He got close, but he says not too close in order for him to not change the situation. And he saw that the chief was faking it out, that he was writing. And Levi-Strauss says that then he realized how writing is a way to control others and to slave others and to make yourself superior.
That's
anthropology.
No, this is a story of something that happened in Brazil. What time?
The '50s. I think maybe early. This is Levi-Strauss. This is the main anthropologist of the 20th century. Maybe, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Without a doubt. This is in a book called...
He wrote about what he thought about writing?
Yeah, he wrote about it here. In his memoirs, ethnography, notes, Tristropics. That's the title in English also. You can buy that. This is the fourth chapter. It's really clear. The title of the chapter says the Nahuica chief and writing or something like that. It's really obvious what chapter it is. And this is you can also read that, just buy a book about the history of writing. And the first chapter is going to be about how the first tablets of writing we have are list. Four at least. So writing was invented for us to know how much does it belong to us. So there's a direct link between writing and capitalism, writing and gathering, writing and lists, writing and empires. So writing is always imperialistic. There's no way. As writers, we're not going to be involved in a way with empire. But there's a way that we... Two options. Well, at least I see two options. One is to understand how can we cure or make less bad, or how to improve writing, how to spiritualize writing, and to use a tool of empire to counterattack, to go beyond empire, whatever you decide. Or a more radical step, which would be to
would be to try to even subvert the writing itself, instead of trying to change the thing, change actual writing.
Difficult thing. Yeah. But do you realize how much it changes once you are aware of all of them? Like your approach as a writer, as a concrete, you know how much the field expands of what the problem is? Instead of like being writers, like encapsulated in current definitions of writing in a small world, how much when the problem gets bigger. It gets bigger. But I mean that's reality. The other was just a fantasy of learning small techniques or this is like bigger. This is a monster. So there's a relationship between writing and imperialism, a historic and psycho-historical relation to it. That's a problem. But that's our problem. And maybe some of them have taken a more radical approach to it. What some people have discovered this, they just have go beyond writing. Because they discovered there was no solution there. So they became performance artists, oral artists, they became wise men. They abandoned, like Krishnamurti, he's a writer. I'm not a writer. Krishnamurti. Jay or I think in it. No.
Krishnamurti.
I think with two M's, I'm not too sure, right? Even in YouTube you can find
books.
Yeah.
Is it Indian philosophy? Yeah, or he would probably be like, I'm not a philosopher.
Yeah. No. Something else.
He's some dude.
Yeah, he had no definition for himself.
Yeah.
He had no definition
about it. Like when people would ask him about stuff.
And no religion.
Yeah. Like interviews and stuff or talks that people would transcribe and they'd be like, well, yesterday you were talking about this. He'd be like, no, I wasn't. No, like...
Yeah. YouTube. So just get into YouTube. He's really radical. I mean, he's really
radical. Why are we talking about him?
Because he believes he's this Indian thinker.
Okay.
At the same time, writer, because he had books. Mm-hmm. He produced them orally. He didn't revise anything. He said that all that it came from him, he cannot like change anything. He accepted whatever came from his mouth. So his books are just whatever he said in any given moment.
What is he talking about?
The reality. What is the structure of language, society? I mean, what poets and writers talk about. Violence, America. He talks a lot about America. He learned English. Most of what he did was in English to reach a bigger audience, he said. So this guy is really right.
Is that the one that died this year?
No.
That's a different one.
That's a different one. No. Yeah, books by him here. He's the best. I mean, there's not that. To my opinion, there's no person. This is the last great, whatever he was called. Okay, let's just look at words, for example. Right? Religion, the word religion, comes from... to reunite. Ligare, in Spanish, ligare is like ligare, like to put two things together, ligare. So religion means to religare, to reunite. Because religion feels there's something you have lost, so you need to religare with that. Religate. Or, for example, your word intelligence, right? This is the way you write it, right? Intelligence. Nothing wrong with that. Comes from inter,
Because so our main notions, religion, intelligence, all of them come from the feeling we need to like reunite, to interunite. Intelligence is the art of interuniting things. Religion is the art or activity of two things that used to be together, put them back together. In the case of religion, me and God. Right? So all our main notions are notions of attachment, of not letting go, of building up. So we are like civilizations all about gathering. That's why capitalism all over. So, but they are like thinkers, cultures that had visions about like not to relegate, not to do religion, but to accept death, to accept expansion, to accept disintegration, to accept like the universe, right? Which is separating itself from itself, right? The universe is not like contracting, right? The universe is like separating itself. So atoms are building a bigger space between them. So, but we feel like the need to do the contrary movement. An electron is going, don't go electron. I'm gonna keep you in orbit. Right? So, as writers, these two models, two general models, one which is clearly identified with imperialism, and one which is not, and the other one which is not so clearly, maybe it is, related to imperialism, has no names. It's a project, an ongoing project. It's something that is not clearly defined. There are not even names for that activity. As you can see, there are not enough concepts to talk about that. So that's a field, for example, that I'm interested in, and maybe you are interested in also, or I don't know. The objective for me in this week has been for that like new field of action as you as writers. To be aware of that. To be aware of that. Instead of just falling automatically, without being aware of it, in the model of writing as imperialism. And as you can see, imperialism in a deeper sense than what we normally call imperialistic. Which is like just there's an iceberg, tip of the iceberg. That the traditional notion of imperialism is so much bigger. Empire is how you transform time, change, transformation, dissipation into space, gathering, collection, market, like the market, right? Etc. etc. So how to write in imperialistic terms and how to write in whatever you call the other approach. Okay. Questions? Let me know what you're thinking. There's a mortal silence. I want to know what that mortal silence means. What are you thinking? Okay.
Okay, so this one makes a lot of sense. So now is the test to see ourselves as empire? Is that the idea?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so right. Okay, so I'm just trying to think about, now that I understand more fully what it means to write in an imperial way, because that's like, this history of technique, like, and the way things have been thought about. So now, you know, to write in a way that's giving, assuming that you are empire. I don't know, I feel like it's kind of vague now, like, I don't know. I don't know where to go from here. Do you?
Great.
Yeah.
Great. So it means you're going to discover something new. You don't know where you are going to. If you knew where you were going to, that an old path. You can even see it. Somebody made it, so you can see it. So you now you don't see anything. Where are you going? That means a new path. Right?
Yeah.
Which is like fear involved in that. Fear involved in that. Obscurity. Non-knowledge. No security. No authorities there. Nobody can help you. Nobody can help you. No teachers there. There you have plenty of teachers. Like, for example, today, an empire of quotes, names, knowledges, right? You can have like an American teacher. He would only know this about America because Americans have empires, American empires. I know about Latin American literature too, and about European literature too. So I'm a bigger empire. I can quote names, imperialistic models from Latin America too. So I'm an empire too. I'm building a pantopia, right? This is a pantopia, right? So you can go further from that. Gabriel, what are you like thinking, wondering? No, come on! It doesn't need to be in like. You don't need to have the same ideas or even similar ideas that anybody here. It's about you. This workshop is about you. So what's your like thinking? What are you now desiring to have to do? What are you wondering about?
About the vortex.
Okay.
I don't know. I was thinking about the whole everything separating, spaces separating, and everyone wants to unite on Earth or something. But,
no, you do know. You're explaining it right now, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everybody's trying to unite right now, right? It's globalization, for example. And globalization is like the practice of a pantopia, right? Of a political and practical everyday pantopia, like the internet pantopia, like the market.
Good.
What do you think?
Is that good? Like, I don't know. Depends on how.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It depends on how. It can depend on how. You know, you can build pantopias to control, because this is my question now. Is a pantopia possible? Is a United States possible? A space where everything is there? Is it possible?
Mm-hmm.
Just a fantasy. Right? Just a fantasy. What's happening in a pantopia? If I design a university that gathers every culture, or if I design a page where everything is going in, what is going to happen?
If everything is there, then it's nowhere.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Because eventually it's all there. And so then even it itself is there, which means it's somewhere else that doesn't exist.
It's just a fantasy.
Yeah.
It's just a fantasy. Pantopia is a fantasy. But that fantasy rules our world.
an topic can never be accomplished. If I try, for example, today to talk about all of poetry, I'm going to choose. And was, oh, I talked about every country. What I did was to select canonical pieces and say that they represent. So in a pantopia, what you do is you eliminate most of it. And you build a space of parts. Parts separated from their real context to build a fictitious context that gives the illusion of a total space. Like a market where you can find food from all over the world. And what you can only find there is the food that is the cliche of that culture. So what happens in Pantopias is that you have spaces of apocryphal totality.
What?
Apocryphal, like false totality. Pseudo, like pseudo holds. You have just lines. You have what capitalism is all about. You have globalizations. Right? Globalizations. Like globalization. Oh, everyone is going to be in a global village. Right? And what is the reality behind that? The killings of cultures. False democracies. The UN. All of that crap. So we can see what globalization is really like. We can see that in our daily realities. So why to attempt practices of writing, and I would add of living, that portray, represent in poetical or existential terms this same logic of gathering, of globalizing, of constructing spaces of total line, of no history, of no time. Because what does time do? What time does is to disintegrate, to accept loss. My mother, my grandmother dies. That happens thanks to time. My family disintegrates through time. Or I can not accept time and build a memory of them. So I live the now with the memory of them. So I don't live. I am part of me is in the past. So memory is the way that we try to fantastically eliminate time, which is disintegration, which is no memory. So time disintegrates. I'm getting old thanks to time, thanks to the miracle of time. I'm gonna die. But because we live in societies that don't accept death, we try to destroy time. In fantastic ways, as in literature, in very practical ways, as in memory, or in very terrific, horrendous practices, such as wars or empires. But throughout all of those, there's one logic. The logic of not accepting disintegration. The logic of preserving. The logic of gathering. What are you thinking right now? Please, we are like getting close to the week's end, so I like want to like listen to you more now.
I was thinking about the thing about the pseudo-holes, the pseudo-totality. How do you avoid that if all the space around us is being produced to reflect that and replicate that? You know, we walk over here to Pearl Street. That's a pseudo totality. Mm-hmm. We go to the Mark. Everywhere is starting to look like that to put us in that. How do we get out of that if everywhere we try to go it's the same thing?
First of all, to be aware of it. I mean, that's a big step. To be aware of that. To really be aware of that. That's the first step. You need to recognize yourself. You're not into that phase of spirituality, of mentality, of being. Yeah, to really understand that. Because what's going to happen next is tomorrow it's going to be Saturday, and I'm going to try to forget about what I already know. So we need to be on the hunt of not letting the now go. Not to remember what I learned. No. Because that's memory. But to, again, perceive the now. So if you, like, stay on that awareness of now, you can understand that there's no way you can gather, right? Because the now is about, like, expansion. And secondly, if you want to start to live so radically the now, that new ways of living and writing are going to appear. Because this is a historical logic. It's not eternal. It looks like the construction of pseudo-holes, of pseudo-totalities, is like natural. There's no way, unavoidable. It looks like that now. That's an illusion of capitalism. So if you start to see, if you start to perceive, this is going to happen. The elements of pseudo-totalities, the elements, the parts of pseudo-systems, you're going to start to perceive them and see how much different each thing is in relation to the next one. So you're not going to even perceive pseudo-totalities. We still perceive pseudo-totalities because we still perceive that there's something that they share. There's a United States there. And I can criticize that. To say that's a pseudo-totality. But it still means that my mind has similar categories that those that builded that pseudo-totality. I'm criticizing that, but I'm still seeing it. I can even criticize it because I see it, right? And that means I'm not aware enough. That means that my perception is too close, is still too close to that of capitalism. Am I explaining myself? Mm-hmm. So when you increase your perception, what used to be artificially united loses all its attachments. So you're not going to be in a world with pseudo-totalities all over. Right? Because there's nothing wrong going on. What is happening is that we share the same kind of nightmares, the same kind of dreams about the United States. Some of us in a negative way, some of us in a more supposedly positive way. But because we share them, we act as if that was real. So I get into a university, for example, and I feel that I must behave in a certain way because I see professors, and I get into that, and I still say, you fucking professors, American professors. But I still limit myself because I feel that there's a United States going on there.
That doesn't bother you?
It's a fantasy.
But I mean you, your experience, because you're limiting yourself. Okay.
I don't have the experience of limiting myself. Not now. I can say whatever I want. I can say whatever I want. I don't try to fit the Naropa model. Like, I'm Naropa. I even decided Naropa. Yeah, okay. Like, because I like to play with words. Naropa. Naropa in Spanish can mean nothing else. Ropa. Clothes. Naropa. Naropa. No clothes.
Yeah.
No masks. That for me Naropa means that. Naropa. No clothes. No limits. I can preach against the United States. I go to the American universities to preach against the United States. I'm not afraid of the FBI, of CIA, somebody not paying me because not inviting me again. People can say they want to preserve languages because they are losing languages, and I don't agree with that. So I say what we need is to let go of languages, even Indian languages, Spanish, English, to let them die. I don't care. Even if I had the feeling I was limiting myself, it would be fictitious. There's no way nobody can limit herself. Repression is an illusion Freud had. He thought of himself and Europe and men so powerful he is so powerful that he can repress somebody. That's a dad's dream. Right? That's a father's dream. The dream that can be so oppressive that I can control my son. And Freud believed that fantasy was true, and he built this concept of repression. And so we all talk about repression. Oh, I'm repressed. It's an illusion. There's no way energy can be trapped. Do you remember letters? I can say, this is the way P controls energy. Do you really think that a symbol can control energy? Do you really feel that energy is being trapped in?
Trapped, like the term trap and the term manipulate, I think are two different, like similar thing. Mm-hmm. It's a similar experience. Is energy trapped? No, but is it manipulated? Yeah.
Yeah, if you believe that this can be true, it will happen. Because fantasies, because of mind games, can become realities. The U.S., for example, was afraid of an attack, Soviets, right? So afraid that it sent a message to people who wanted to attack somebody else. And the guy who was afraid of being attacked and the guy who wanted to attack joined forces. That's why Saddam and Bush encountered each other. They needed them. So an illusion can become reality. If I feel, okay, let's suppose I'm from Tijuana and I'm a Marxist teacher and I'm really hate Americans, and they invite me to Naropa. And since the invitation, I've been pinching. They want me to give up my ideas. They want me to forget about my socialism for $750, $100, pinching.
So I come here with that attitude, and I see you, and I see agents of imperialism. and I see the Chicanos. I know the Chicanos. That white guy. And I can fall into that fantasy. And so I would limit myself. I would say, I'm not going to give you the Borges or the Sama Lima quote because they're going to use it against us. And so what would happen? That I would make a fantasy because that's not happening. Right? Right? I'm making a fantasy become reality. You are gonna feel, he's gonna feel I have something against him. Because something is like happening. He's gonna go to his house, he's like, Mexicans are like, I met some Mexicans and some of them are like, they hate us. So his definition of Mexican is gonna be affected by my fantasy. Because I didn't like see him. I saw something else. A gringo, a preconceived notion. And I, when I encounter him, I impose onto him the image I already had. So I didn't see him. I didn't see Steve. I saw an image, a spectacle. Guy Debord calls this spectacle. I saw a memory. I didn't perceive Steve. I had a memory. So there was no awareness. But I had was memory. Right? So memory is what builds empires, what builds non-perception. Right? All of them write true memories. They don't write about the now. They write using memories. Quotes, clichés, images, fantasies of something which is not there. All the Mexicans, all the Americans. I'm in Tijuana thinking about Americans. There's no American in kilometers, but I'm defining Americans. I would be using images from TV to define Americans. Fantasies. Real simple, right? You can like memorize or you can perceive. What we call perception is nothing but memory. So the experience of perception is something we may have not done yet. So maybe perception, I've never perceived anything. Maybe today, maybe right now is the first time I see. And that can be, that's not a fantasy, yeah? That's not a fantasy. That's what happens to people all the time. They had a problem, they don't interact with life now, but they are like holding onto experiences of the past. And so they encounter a new woman, a new man, and they are like afraid, angry, and they don't build a new couple because they don't let go of the painful experiences of the past. For example, in love, mm-hmm. In terms of love. They're not open because they don't let go of the memory of how painful it was. So they are not in the now, they're in the past. Even though that's impossible, it's a fantasy, but they are inside that fantasy. And in terms of writing, that also happens. I confront the page, and the first things that appear in my mind are, is it going to be a short story? Is it going to be a poem? Got it? We separate it from the now. I'm a philosopher. I'm an experimental poet. I'm an expert on. I'm a playwright. I'm a fiction writer. So that's how I don't accept the now, and how I cling to identities, to things I did before. That's why it gets frustrating to write, because you feel that the present moment needs to refer to what you did yesterday. And that task is very stressful. That is like fulfilling an expectation. And you start to feel like, am I going to be able today to do it? Because you don't accept that's not here anymore. That was yesterday. And yesterday I felt that this was a novel. And that idea of doing that novel, that moment helped me to... But that was then.
But I wonder about, like, okay, for example, yesterday when I turned on the stove, I burned my hand on the flame because it got too big, okay? Mm-hmm. So I need to remember that today, that if I let the flame get too big, I'm going to burn my hand. I need to be mindful of that. There's something in, like, some things that happen, like, are going to happen again, whether you're living in the now or not. If you turn the stove on, you're going to burn your hand. So you need. How do you reconcile those two ideas at the same time?
Why did you burn your hand?
Well, I didn't really. I used it for
example. Okay. But let's say that's time. Why did you burn your hand? Because you had the memory of it. You had the memory of it. What happens in a bad or wrong way to us is how the unconscious, remember, that's never not be aware that the unconscious exists. That's a reality. We can see it. It's visible. So that everything that happens in a bad way to us is how the unconscious plays a trick on us. So being afraid of the flame is exactly how you're going to get burned soon.
But what about things like, so say, okay, I'm with you there, but what if I burned myself because I didn't know how to use the stove correctly? And so when I tried to use it, I didn't use it right, and now it burns me. So now I need to learn from that moment and to remember how to use it correctly so it's not going to burn me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's going to take a pain to learn, to grow. And if you really grew, you're not going to be afraid of that. That is not going to be part of, like, the next now.
But I guess what I'm saying is, how do you live in the now and be aware of the things that you've already learned? Like you were saying, like, these two
lose
people...
Lose it.
Lose what?
The knowledge. Because knowledge is memory.
So then I can continue to get burned.
Yeah.
By the same mistakes that I... Like, fine, okay, I can continue to get burned, but, like, I could also, like, make another mistake, you know, instead. But instead of too busy getting burned by the stove every day, I'm getting...
First of all, it's not going to happen. First of all, it's not going to happen. The desire to repeat is at the same time... the fear that propels the repetition. So you now, like, fear that it is going to be repeated, because that's how mind acts when it is in repeats, when it does repeat itself. And so, because it is repeating itself, it thinks reality is about you may repeat this. Because that's what's happening. If you repeat, you're going to be afraid of repeating. If you don't repeat, repetition is not a category, because it's never the same. Repetition cannot happen. You burn, and tomorrow maybe you burn in another way. It wasn't the same burning. Maybe you find a way to not burn, to put a hand in the fire. You're not going to burn. You're going to develop new ways of experiencing things. Obviously, like kissing, kiss, and then you find a way of experiencing that kiss differently. Writing, you can suffer writing, and then you can remember it. I used to suffer, I think so. And then you are going to forget. And then you know, something happened to me. Because I don't even remember if I used to suffer. At that moment, it means you really reach something new. Something really happened. You transformed yourself. You don't even remember. What you remember means that you're like in the process of letting go. But once you let go, you let go. That example you give is images that come to our mind when we are inside the state of repetition. And why is that image coming to my mind and your mind? Because we want to say, no, the now cannot happen. The new is risky. We want to have proofs that our normal way of living is okay, is the best way. You want me to say, you're right.
No, I just want to, like in the context of empire, and empires happen again and mm-hmm. again and again and again. So like, okay, I want to be able to understand mm-hmm. how to live in the now and create.
Don't be afraid.
Space.
Don't be afraid. It's if there's a like emotion we can point to, fear. The United States is increasing because of fear. Fear of the United States. So if we in Mexico stay afraid of the United States is going to take over. We are, that fear is the way we call the United States to come, the soldiers to come. They detect fear and they go there. If we like just know that there's no way the United States can take over, that's a fantasy. It's not going to take over. The fantasy of the United States is going to decrease until it's there's no more United States there. The United States is made up of fear. Same as writing, right? Same as writing. You hold on to because you're afraid of. And so your empire as a writer increases because you're afraid. And because you're afraid, you make other people afraid of you. That's why in writers' communities there's so much fear, right? Fear of not being approved, fear of not being published, fear of not being liked by readers, fear of not ending the book I'm starting, fear of not being a good book, a good writer. Say, writing is all about fear. I mean, talk to people, right? So it's about fear. Mostly about being approved, being accepted by others, being published, being recognized, having enough money. If I'm a good writer, is that does mean that I'm going to have money, or can I be a good writer and not have money? Mm-hmm. Right? That's a big problem, right? That's a fantasy. If you're a good writer, remember reality. So the writing community is made up of people who are afraid. So there, a new writer, a good writer, appears. Somebody who doesn't have fear. What do you think is going to be the reaction of a whole bunch of thousands of people who are afraid? Most of them even afraid of writing. That's why they read. They like literature so much, but they are so afraid, they have so much fear, that they consider themselves readers. even though all of them are writers. All of them. All of them. So what do you think is going to be the reaction to somebody who doesn't have fear in a community of people controlled by their own fear?
They're not going to like that.
At first.
Yeah.
At first, they are not going to like it. Exactly. And then, after a couple of years in this real market we are,
then that maybe some people will tell them that it's okay to like it, and then they'll like it.
That's real.
Right? I don't know. Is that,
yeah, you do know, right? You just said it. You do know. Right? Just listen to ourselves. We say something, we knew it. And then what do we say? In Spanish or English? In Spanish is no same thing. And English is?
I don't know.
You
don't want to take responsibility for that.
Right? You do know. That is what happens. So if you write in a different way at first, you're not going to be accepted, obviously. And then time is going to pass, not so much time, a couple of years, 3, 4, 5, maximum, 8 years. You're going to be really successful.
What, 8?
With 7, 6. Yeah, yeah.
Because you were like 8 years.
No, exactly. Me too, eh? Me too.
I see 2 months.
Yeah. Exactly. After the reading that you read something and people didn't know of you, but they noticed, and you went to the place that you knew people were open to. You didn't choose the place where you're going to be. You don't like suffering. You choose places where you know people are more open. You don't choose Ku Klux Klan meetings. Right? You choose a better place because you don't want to suffer there. It's gonna be immediate. It's gonna be immediate. People are gonna know. So nothing bad is gonna happen. Nothing bad is gonna happen.
But
I
was just saying, how do we get rid of fear?
Confront it. What did you fear?
In general, or it was not being accepted, sort of being shunned. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of it.
Do you accept yourself?
Sometimes.
That's the problem. Mm-hmm. When you accept yourself, that's the real world.
That's the real thing.
Yeah. When you accept yourself, everybody's going to accept yourself.
So it's sort of like about self-awareness first, right? Mm-hmm. Observing the self first. And
it's going to happen because, remember, projections. Mm-hmm. So the image is in my head. I have an image in your head. It's mm-hmm. going to obey your being.
But like on like huge like scales, like people's ideas about like gender or race, it's like huge like individual projected fantasies that become like these things. So when I look around, I say, you know, oh, the Chinese are bad drivers. Every time I see a Chinese person, they're a bad driver. You know, like,
yeah.
So how
yeah.
do, how
with that,
we can't, like, as individuals, we can't stop that.
Obviously. You are a Chinese person,
yeah.
You become a good driver, you become not only a good driver, but the best driver. Everybody in the world is going to see on TV that the best driver is a Chinese. So the illusion changes. So you become, you accept yourself, and which is really radical. It, because it is so radical, it's going to be so new, so mind transforming that the image in millions of people are going to change.
Mm-hmm.
like an actress or an actor,
mm-hmm.
coming from another culture that we used to think that culture, and takes only one really good actor to change the way people see Mexicans, the way people see Chinese. Just took one person who decided to be like whatever she or he does. For example, that's the way I don't know if in my environment there was like bias against blacks, or like that association between being black and not being like intelligent.
Yeah.
But at the moment, I've read, which was kind of early, black writers. At the moment I knew about like Baraka, I associated black writers with radical. Like in my life, it was like took one guy, that guy, the Baraka guy, one. Took a book. So I now like teach people in Tijuana that changes dozens. Those, each one of them changes dozens. One guy. So this doesn't take, I mean, if you like accept yourself, you become radical. You become radical, you just become a soul standing that the single individual really changes. The thing is that we don't decide to be accept ourselves, and so the next stage of the process never happens. So it's as, for example, as writers, we don't need to learn techniques. That's the like the fearful way. I need to learn techniques to be a good writer. So I need to more info. That's what universities are all about. That's not the way it happens. It happens in the whole, just even take the universities, have all those memories with you, but really be aware of history and study people's lives, writers' lives that have done that. All of them have broken with conceptual reality. All of them. All of them have not let other people judge them. All of them have been radical. All of them have been in a search inside themselves. So even if I accept memory, history tells me how to do it. If I don't have the courage to do it by myself, okay, I'm going to do it through memory. But really study the memory we have. And all of them did it that way. You don't need to know anything in order to write in a different or really interesting way. Or do you really believe that writers have always come from countries that have so much information gathered that they produce these individuals? Do you think that it's about techniques or information? Do you really think that writers come from them? Are you so like immersed in the fantasies of American society that you really think that's the path that takes you to like being a writer? I mean, a really, really good writer. Have American universities been so successful at that dream, at propagating the American dream, that all of us believe that's the way? That's a question. I'm making a question.
Yeah, I think the answer is yeah.
That's what I was thinking. Pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay.
Money,
well,
prestige like that equals like good.
Yeah. You know, that, like, from the, like, yeah.
This
fence, that equals good. That equals you're a good person. You're worthy. You have money. You have prestige. It equals worth. Anything else, you might as well, you're fucked.
Anything else, you don't even exist.
You're not human.
Who
you're
are you?
It's not human.
You're not even here.
Yeah, you are not a human being. Yeah.
What about the others? Okay. Thank you. No, really, thank you. That's really awesome. What about others? I mean, yeah. Both of them, like, spoke about what we as a society believe, and sometimes we, and me, I believe that. Yeah, right. It's a fantasy. Come on. I want to listen to you.
I mean, even if you do become, like, a really great writer or whatever, like, by renouncing those things, it's still wanting prestige to be a great writer. I mean, that's still there. I think that's, like, a human thing, I think. I don't think that's even just endemic to America. I think that's just everywhere. You know? I mean, America's a little more fucked up about it, I think. By far, I would think. But, you know, I mean, but I think that's just
it's going to happen.
Yeah.
So if it is going to happen, you're going to be successful, good, and why be afraid of it? It is going to happen. That's bottom reality. So now the question is, why to be afraid of it? Why live in that stage, in that reality, with
like,
fear?
You mean like to be afraid of failure, or to be afraid of the process itself, or to be afraid of falling into that whole thing of like trying too hard and to, like, you know, become like a hack or something like that, or
all of them? Being afraid of all
fear in general. Like, I feel like for the past few years, I've really consciously try to create stuff that is not going for publication or any of that purposely. Like, I don't want to sell anything. I just want to write and create. And I want to live in a way that integrates that as a process. So it's about living. How do I live my life? And writing is a part of that. And I don't care if it doesn't get published, you know, and accepted and all of that stuff. But I feel like you have a sense of, like, no, you should publish, you should create books, you should be successful and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering how you address that, because to me it's a part of, like, no, I just want to use writing to live better in my life. That's all I care about.
Yeah.
If I can use it to create, you know, connections with other people, mm-hmm. to create spaces that are, you know, that are maybe, that allow for this kind of dialogue,
mm-hmm.
that's fine for me. That's all I care about.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I want.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then I feel like there is pressure, or there is, like, this sense of, like, no, like, you should put your ideas out there. Like, otherwise, then it's just like catharsis, no? Like, you're just writing your diary. You're just
mm-hmm.
writing, and you're not creating a book out
mm-hmm.
of it. Is that real? Like, is that where
yeah.
you're coming from? Like, what do you think?
No, it's about growth, right? It's about, like, changing, not being the same. So the process in a writer, I think, like, as a start, it's great to not think about publication, just enjoy to writing as a part of your life. What's going to happen is that they're going to encounter other people who are going to enjoy your work, and one of them is going to say, okay, I have a friend who has a publishing house or something like that. And then you need to grow, to accept. It's not about, like, I want to publish, so I'm going to look. No, no, what's going to happen? You enjoy writing so much, other people are going to listen to you or read you somehow, and they are going to invite you to the next level
mm-hmm.
of more people enjoying your work. And if at that moment you decide not to, you're now not accepting the new reality. which is the world. Somebody wants you to be part of their world. And if you don't like accept, just accept the new reality, like being passive about it, okay. Somebody said, why don't you give me a book in English? Okay. Instead of fighting myself, right, I accepted a new reality. There's somebody who can publish me a book in English. I was planning for, if I remember correctly, I was planning like another book in Spanish, something like that, for those 3, 5, or 6, or 8 months, or whatever. And I changed reality because I thought this invitation is an opportunity I have to accept the new reality of my life. A new reality. So you're going to accept it. The publishing opportunity is not going to come because you are so anxious about it that it's going to come. It is going to come because you enjoy writing. You write in an enjoying way, and other people are going to invite you to publish.
And that's not corrupting.
That's an image. It's about writing. People are going to enjoy your book after they work hard. Somebody's going to learn how to read. Somebody's going to learn that somebody thinks like he or she thinks. And until that moment, she or he felt isolated. Or somebody's going to get mad at you, so his emotions are going to, her emotions are going to like, it's gonna, he or she was gonna feel alive again for a moment. When Ruben is wrong. You're gonna provoke life. You're not going to be going. There's no way you can corrupt. People who we identify as corrupt had so many images of being corrupt that they became that image for us. It's that, don't confuse yourself with images like that, because they are going to become true. Come on, you're writing. You can increase the level of awareness, the level of pleasure, the level of intensity. If writing can do that, why put in the middle of that images of something else? Why ruin that? That's where the corrupting element comes in. Because some part of myself knows that I'm putting images of fantasies in the middle of a pleasurable experience. So there's a fear of being corrupt there, because it is happening in fantasies. Do you really think I'm corrupt?
Do I think you're corrupt?
But if I thought I was corrupt, when I made that question, you would say, your awareness would be aware of some sense of me being corrupt. Why? Because I thought I was corrupt. And so you would look at that. And I would like, see you so the next time I'm going to remember that question and your look, and the next time I did that question to somebody else, I had the memory of them, and I felt I was corrupt. I don't know how, but I felt I'm corrupt. And so, Steve, do you think I'm corrupt? No. Okay, so...
You're beautiful, man.
That perception is going to keep growing, until I become corrupt. In a real, practical way, a corrupted Mexican Professor Tijuanian guy. Until it became reality. That's how reality is being constructed right now. So why start that process? Why separate from reality? Reality is about pleasure growing, disintegrating, expanding. Why start that process with fantasies that cannot stop that process? That can only stop my awareness of that process taking place. As writers, we need to know what's happening. Our main resource is to be aware. It's not about techniques. It's not about what are you reading or what teachers, if you're in an American university or a third world university. And I mean third lessons. Third world. It's not about that. It's about something much more radical. Much more radical. Much more radical. If this week each of us has thought about something that we weren't aware of before, the goal was accomplished by yourself, not by me. If you feel that now you are more happy with yourself, more profound, more at the same time superficial, more here, right, at the surface, instead of being hiding, if you're right now here, if you really feel the city, that noise, right? The images you're having right now, like me or this background, if you really feel more here, then the goal was accomplished. But I think this is the moment to say goodbye and to accept loss. Most probably we're not going to see each other ever. Never ever. Nunca más.
Well, you're reading on Saturday, right?
Yeah.
Are
you not going to be there?
Okay.
See you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope we could see more, talk more, learn more techniques. The time is four sessions is not enough. But at the same time, more than enough, I think. Right? So, there are no teachers. There are no teachers. There are no teachers. Let's do a final exercise. Whoever thinks that teachers exist, don't go outside. She or he is going to stay here to wait for the teacher to come. Okay.